I was very interested in the previous presentation because this will be kind of an interesting follow-on, I think, to the discussion about how what can be done in post-conflict situations. I'm going to be talking, in terms of partnership, I'm going to be talking about NGOs and ministries of health as partners. And I have no relationships to disclose. And I want to first acknowledge my colleagues, Dr. Rui Maria de Arauch, who was the first Minister of Health of Timor-Leste, and Susan Thompson, excuse me, for their work on this paper. So most of us that are involved in global health understand that if we're going to achieve the MDGs, we really need to strengthen government health systems in developing countries. And doing that, I mean, it's a particularly acute challenge if you're in this post-conflict, post-trauma situation where that immediate need for relief takes precedence over the strengthening of public systems of care. Another challenge to developing these stronger health systems is this current push to privatize care. So NGOs in particular, we've got a lot, there's been a huge increase in NGO funding global health, and although I think most of us understand that NGOs do have some advantages over governments in some situations, I mean, in particular, they tend to be more flexible, more innovative, able to do things quickly that maybe governments can't. But there are a lot of concerns about funding NGOs in global health preferentially. Primarily, to me, it's that NGOs are really legally only accountable to their donors, not to the people that they are meant to serve, as governments should be accountable. And also in a lot of countries, massive numbers of international health NGOs make coordination by these governments that are supposed to be coordinating them quite a nightmare. And NGOs often will develop a little, their own little small-scale health system that then competes with the public sector so that it's, instead of strengthening public sector, it's actually weakening. So I'm going to talk about the history of the role of health NGOs in over the first decade of this of a new post-conflict country, Timor-Leste, formerly known as East Timor, and then illustrate that role with the experience of the NGO that I work for, Health Alliance International. So East Timor was half of an island north of Australia. It was this little backwater Portuguese colony for over 400 years, and then in 1975, Portuguese left it, and it was invaded and underwent a very brutal, illegal occupation by Indonesia. So under this oppressive Indonesian domination, at least a quarter of the population died from either direct warfare, starvation, or disease in the 24 years of that occupation. And the cemeteries really are just full of the graveyards of young people who perished during this period, and also those who lived suffered really incredible human rights abuses. Then in 1999, Timor was granted the right to vote on either greater autonomy, so staying within Indonesia, staying as a part of Indonesia, or independence, and they overwhelmingly voted for independence. But directly following that vote, there was this even more violent campaign of retribution by the Indonesian supported militias. And you see kind of in a couple of those pictures what the country looked like after the vote. There were some 1,500 more deaths. 75% of the country's infrastructure was destroyed, mostly burned. They just burned everything. They were quite angry at the vote. And about 75% of the population was displaced, either through just fear having to leave, or they were forcibly moved out of East Timor into Indonesia and West Timor. Well, finally, after about 3 weeks of really total mayhem, the UN troops were allowed in, and very shortly, international agencies arrived, including international NGOs. And for about the next almost 2 years, most of the health services for this whole country of about a million people, most of the health services were provided by NGOs, mostly international NGOs, and also some of the existing Catholic clinics that were in the country already and had been there before. What these NGOs found when they arrived was really pretty serious destruction. This is a destroyed health clinic, but it's very typical. More than a third of the health facilities were completely destroyed. Nearly all the equipment and supplies were damaged or looted. It was really a very traumatized population. And certainly the rapid response of these international NGOs that came in at that point was very critical in providing some sense of stability, some sense that the people were being cared for. But although they were quite competent in these emergency situation, coordinating their efforts was enormously difficult, and their operations were very costly. At that point, there was a national trust fund, a healthcare trust fund, that from donor countries that was at about $13 million total, and these NGOs were using up about $6 million a year of that trust fund. And that was $13 million that had been pledged, and I don't think it ever even came through. So this approach of NGOs running the health services was clearly unsustainable financially. But there was also a very strong felt need to develop a national health system, a Timorese health system for this new country. Doing this, though, was going to be a challenge because there really were very limited numbers of Timorese staff that could take on that responsibility. There were Timorese midwives, but they had a range of training, and many of them were really not terribly skilled, even in midwifery, and certainly not in management. Practically no Timorese doctors and very few mid-level managers. They had all been Indonesians who had left. So despite that concern, the health authorities did decide to phase over the NGO services to a locally staffed Ministry of Health. And this was kind of the plan. So first to establish a lead NGO for each of the 13 districts, then develop district health management teams so they would try to bring together the Timorese staff that were available, recruit expat clinical staff as needed. They really needed to have at least one doctor per district. And talk about with the local staff what kind of disruptions might happen, and then try to identify what those risks were and address the risks. This decision itself was a pretty risky decision. I think a lot of NGOs I remember talking to at the time were very angry, and most people really were concerned because of that a very widespread belief that Timorese could not maintain health services without the NGOs. But the process moved forward. By the target date, there were locally provided services in all 13 districts. There were no abrupt disruptions of services. And afterwards, after the transition had taken place, then the Ministry of Health asked NGOs to submit proposals for projects that would emphasize the Ministry of Health priorities, so cost effectiveness, reaching difficult to reach populations, the usual, you know, priorities, community participation. So basically, this new Ministry of Health that was still dealing with some very serious post-conflict problems essentially took charge of assuring that the NGOs in the country worked with them under their guidelines rather than as separate and unaccountable entities. Right now, there are about 25 health NGOs working under these guidelines. Some are part of national, and a few, I would say probably two or three, are part of the national strategic plans, both in the planning process and as technical resources. So the NGO that I work for is considered the major a major technical resource for maternal and newborn care. And interestingly, scholars that have studied this nation-building process in Timor-Leste found that the health sector fared substantially better than the other governmental sectors, and they believed it was at least in part because of that early process of Timorizing the health system. So what have been the results in the country? Well, a comparison of health statistics shows that in terms of utilization, we have certainly improvements, you know, pretty substantial improvements in antenatal care, in percent that were protected with tetanus toxoid, skilled birth attendance, and then the percent having a facility delivery, which more than doubled. We also have, because there was a demographic and health survey in 2003 and then another one in 2006, or 2009, I'm sorry, 6 years later, So we also have some mortality trends, not for maternal mortality, but we have them at least for infant and child. And as you can see, there was a fairly substantial reduction in postneonatal mortality, so that infant mortality and therefore child mortality also went down. No way to attribute cause to this, but it certainly makes the man who was the minister feel that at least they were moving in the right direction. So I'll just finish by talking about HAI. We're a nonprofit international health organization. Our whole aim really is to, among other things, to strengthen relationships, to strengthen Ministry of Health, government health systems. We were in East Timor before that referendum happened, and we're working with grants from both USAID and AustralianAID to support maternal newborn care and family planning. So a good example of how that collaboration works with us has been in the area of family planning. So this 2003 total fertility rate was the highest in the world, 7.8. No place was it ever documented to be any higher than that. So there was before this survey came out, there was a little bit of resistance among, sort of the religious sector, but also the government sector in not wanting and being worried about doing family planning because it was a Catholic country. But once this data came out, it became very clear that the implications for a very poor country and that sort of fertility was very, very high. And we were also concerned, of course, about introducing family planning into this very traumatized country that was Catholic. So first we did a qualitative community assessment to try to get a sense of what were the perceptions of fertility and fertility regulation in these populations. We found a lot of resistance to the idea of sort of family planning as a way of limiting family size. That had been the emphasis in the Indonesian family planning program, two children are enough. But the idea that you could space births in order to improve the health of mothers and children was quite well accepted. And so the National Family Planning, based on that kind of information, the National Family Planning program became Espaço Oan, which is child spacing. And although we talk about family planning when we're in talking to people, it's mostly about child spacing. So we were already working in the country in maternal newborn care, so it wasn't too difficult to move into training midwives to do both supportive supervision of the midwives, to introduce the topic of family planning, et cetera, and child spacing, and also to train them in clinical procedures like IUDs and implant insertions. But clinical services didn't really cover the demand part. There was also a distinct lack of demand for family planning or child spacing. And although the Ministry of Health standards said that the staff should do outreach in the communities, they really didn't have any materials. It wasn't done, essentially. So we started out by just developing the usual little visual aids. These are a set of photo cards around a number of health behaviors. But then realized that in this digital age, it was really that film was really an attractive medium for providing health information. So we worked with MOH staff and with a local filmmaker, produced several films in DVD format to inform and motivate families about health behaviors. And one of these set of films was Espaço Oan. So it's a two-part film, talks about child spacing sort of motivationally and also about contraceptive methods. And the film includes an introduction by the Vice Minister of Health, and also a real coup. One of the more prominent local Catholic bishops is in the film, talking about how responsible parents will space their children. And we were very gratified to find, this is an anatomical apron that they use in a discussion after the film. And we were gratified to see that the fertility rate came down from, you remember, 7.8, at least down to 5.7. Still pretty high, but certainly improved in 2009. So very quickly, our conclusions. We feel very clear that national health authorities need to be able to direct the contributions of health NGOs, even in post-conflict situations, and that managing that transition from emergency to development can be done, but it does require some planning on the part of national health authorities and the authority of national health authorities to do it. and the courage, in fact, to do it, because this was a very, as I said, a risky decision. NGOs can make effective use of their flexibility, their innovativeness, in strengthening government health systems. It doesn't have to be going on their own approach. And also that funding for these kind of efforts requires a certain amount of flexibility on the part of donors, and we have been very fortunate to have very understanding and sort of sympathetic both USAID and AusAID donors. So our hope is that when these little girls get to be mothers themselves, that they will have a government that can provide them with essentially a safe and healthy pregnancy and delivery. Thank you.
Thank all of our presenters, and I am going to try to wrap this up, these diverse presentations, and I think that we've heard a range of different kinds of partnerships, all the way from the basic data and awareness raising that on chronic diseases, which I thank you very much for pointing out, things that I think a lot of us wouldn't have known about from Costa Rica and the United States. And we have research partnerships and also the ethical issues involved with research when we're doing it with partners in other countries. Then we have advocacy and policy partnerships from the tobacco industry, which is just illustrative of many, many other issues. Then technical and capacity building partnerships between surgeons and a dilapidated system and trying to build up that system through post-conflict assistance. And then finally, the role that NGOs can play and do play in building up health systems, both in post-conflict but and also in developing countries where the system was never that great to begin with. I'm going to conclude because that's my job, is to end on time. On the other hand, there's nobody standing at the door to kick us out. So officially, we're done. But we're here, and we'll answer questions until somebody comes. And So until somebody comes to kick us out, I will welcome your questions. I think we had two simultaneously. Luisa, since I know you, I'll give you first, but then you're next. Please, ask your question.
Thank you. I'm Luis Lam from Plan International USA. A question for Dr. Mercer. This cooperation, this collaboration between government and NGOs, has its focus on secondary services, primary government services, or community? And is there has been some reason to focus on one of these subsectors or not?
To work on supporting the clinical sector, that is the public health sector, but that the public health, that the government of Timor-Leste was also determined that they would do community health. And so, for example, the films are shown, there's actually a range of ways they're shown, but for example, the kind of planning film, it will be shown by the Ministry of Health staff at a community meeting to talk about family planning, child spacing with the community. So it's really both. Mm-hmm. And I think it has to be both. And that's kind of the way HAI has always seen it. I think it's a very legitimate role to play.
Only a 5 second comment. And I think it has been the influence of NGOs to emphasize to the government the important role of community work, so that they don't focus only on clinical service.
And to make it possible. I mean, they didn't do it right because they didn't have materials, they didn't have their training, they kind of didn't know how to do it. So
thank
you.
That was fun. Yes. I'm Rick Yoder, Cardinal Emerging Markets. Just two questions or comments about the tobacco issue. One is just among a lot of countries are signatories to various kinds of global treaties and agreements like this. What's the most effective enforcement mechanism that you experienced? Secondly, given that non-communicable diseases and so overtaking infectious diseases are the main burden on disease, and smoking being the number one risk factor, I'd be interested in anybody else who has experience with on USAID projects. And given USAID's standard funding channels of reproductive health and planning, MCH, and TB and HIV/AIDS, there's no room for tobacco work.
Thank
except through indirect means, to get to this. They're pouring lots of money into health programs, which we're all very grateful for, of course. But they seem to be missing the boat in terms of the number one burden of disease factor. Any response to that?
Well, the first part, I think one of the things that the Global Tobacco Treaties did was to put in place requirements for public education and NGO participation. So it wasn't spelled out how the NGO participation would be done, but there are databases and a number of working groups primarily through the Treaty Secretariat on ensuring that we are doing the massive education. So NGOs have a role in monitoring, and then this is a funny analogy, but officiating enforcement. So in a way, it punts the burden back to the civil society, except when you look at the power and influence of the tobacco industry in particular, we just as soon have that kind of responsibility than have it stick with governments who are continuing to do the dirty work of tobacco. Which I think you're basically asking a funding question, right?
USAID doesn't do much chronic disease at all.
Yeah. Anti-smoking work.
Can I just make a suggestion? Tomorrow is at 2:30, I believe, is a presentation on the Global Health Initiative, which is where representatives from USAID will be when they're going to be talking about their priorities. And I think that question probably could be answered by them better than those of us who are up here now. It's in the program, isn't it? It's 2:30 tomorrow, and Amy, do you know the place? That would be an excellent question to put to them, because they will actually be there representing the U.S. government, USAID, State Department, and CDC together on the Global Health Initiative. And that would be an excellent question to ask them, I think. The U.S. government can't fund advocacy of this type anyway. It's prohibited by law. But, Gopal, do you have that location? Yeah, tomorrow, the new U.S. Global Health Initiative, Implications for American Public Health. It will be in 601 in this center from 2:30 to 4. I'm Robert Clay from the USAID Global Health Office. He's from the HIV/AIDS office, but he is officially representing the U.S. government. I think that would be a good question to ask them, because we really don't speak for government policy up here. Any more questions? Well, again, I thank you all for coming. I think these are all, I know I have tons of questions for all of you. I would like to let you know that the International Health Section has a very active policy and advocacy committee, and I think they might be interested in hearing from you, and two people here, and plus myself, couldn't tell you how to get in touch with them. If you have interesting things, we do have a blog that we might be able to put some of your work on that blog, and at least let people know what you're doing. We have many other opportunities, so another plug for the International Health Section. And again, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.